Welcome to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hemmerker. In each episode, she'll talk with your favorite romantic suspense authors. They will take you behind the scenes of the writing process, giving excerpts from their writing, and share stories about their writing life.
Present Danger by Elizabeth Goddard. Former FBI Special Agent Jack Tanner is working as a detective in Montana when he comes across a body in the National Forest during a search and rescue mission. He's committed to finding the killer, even if it means working alongside his old flame, U.S. Forest Service Special Agent Tara Connors. When Tara discovers that the murder victim had ties to a powerful and dangerous trafficker of archaeological artifacts, the investigation takes a deadly turn, one that hits too close to home. As Tara fears she lacks the courage to face what comes next, Jack is more determined than ever to protect her. But he's failed her before. And if he fails this time, it will cost them far more than just their hearts.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm your host, Sarah Hemmerker, and I'm glad you joined me today. My guest is Elizabeth Goddard. She's sold more than a million books and the award-winning author of more than 50 novels and counting, including a lot of romantic mysteries and romantic suspense. So I'm glad that you're going to be on my show. So welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah. I'm glad to be here.
So, that's a lot of books on the show. Now I'm feeling like I'm like the little newbie here. I've only had a few published. How long have you been working on writing and being published?
You know, it seems like yesterday that I started writing, and I'm just like, I'm looking at that too going, I recently just recounted my books because I had on there 40, and I went back and I'm like, this last year, because if you're writing so many a year, well, you know, it adds up and you got to recount. I'm like,
yeah.
Wait a minute, what? I didn't realize I'd written that many. But in 2001 is when I officially joined what was then ACRW, but it's now ACFW, a Christian writing organization, and committed to writing a chapter every week and started attending conferences. And so I really started being serious about trying to get published back then. But it wasn't until 2007 or the end of 2006, my first novel came out. And so, you know, it's a little bit of a slow start with that first novel because they want to see how's it going to do. And then so it was like 2 or 3 years before I started really ramping up, just really writing for sending multiple proposals into my publisher, and then expanding and writing for more publishers. So when you write for more than one publisher, 2 or 3 publishers, then you can really ramp up the book count. So I've been busy for the last few years.
Yes. And so do you is this like your full-time job? How do you manage all that?
Yeah, it's definitely my full-time job. I worked in corporate America in my 20s, and I traveled all over the country. And then when I had my first child, I quit that job because I didn't want to be traveling with a baby. And so it was during that time that I decided that I wanted to focus on my dream of writing. So throughout the years of raising my, you know, I had 3 more children after hers. I have 4 children in total. So during those times, it's just a matter, you know, trying to figure out how I'm going to write and when I'm going to write has all changed many times, you know, depending on the situation. So,
yeah, it is. I have 4 kids as well. And, now that they're older, I'm like, yeah, I mean, they need me, but they don't need me as much as they don't need me to stay alive like they did when they were younger. So that does free a lot of brain power and brain cells when I'm not trying to, you know, make sure everyone is,
I know.
Semi-fed
enough,
close.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I know it sounds weird, but I think it was actually, I had more brain when they were little than I do now. I think it's because I'm older now. So, you know, it's like 6 of one, half a dozen of another. I have more time. But back then I juggled. Sometimes I also homeschooled, and so I would write. You know, sometimes I'd fill the week with homeschool stuff, and then I would just spend the entire day of Saturday writing. You know, I just pump out as many words or however I had to do it, just squeezing in here and there. But it is my full-time job, and now I'm not homeschooling, but, yeah, I get up, and I've got chapters. I've got word count to make every single day, marketing and promotion, and you know, whatever, all the other juggling. So I just make it happen.
Yeah. Well, exciting times to make it happen. So did you always want to be a writer when you were a kid, or did you have other dreams of how we, what adulthood was going to look like?
Oh, yeah. I had, I think it was not really a matter of I wanted to be a writer. I think I was a writer. I was always writing and telling stories as a kid, but I had dreams of being all kinds of things, like an astronaut or marine biologist or this or that. I had so many dreams of things I wanted to be. And I realized now that all of those things fit into writing, right? Because I can be anything I want to be as a writer. I can research, and I have characters who are doing all kinds of things that I could never possibly do in real life. So I think writing was just always something there. But I do remember in high school being UIL writing, creative writing, and all of that. And I just, at that time, thought to myself that I don't want to be a professional writer because I was afraid. You know, all I could think of was Lois Lane, right, being a reporter. That's in my mind.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine making a living, and I didn't want to do that. So I did pursue computer science so I could, you know, survive the world.
Yep.
But then when I had the opportunity, I'm like, you know what? I want to write. I need to write. At the time, I didn't even know what. I mean, I just had that drive to write, and it could be articles, whatever. So I took time to find out what the Lord, you know, I've just prayed and tried to figure out what direction to go. And then I ended up writing romantic suspense novels. So you just walk the path and the doors open and you just keep walking through.
Yeah. Yeah. If it's only as simple as you just made that sound.
Oh, well, of course there's like years and years of complications, you know, struggles. I mean, I don't have like days and days to tell you about all that, but I'm sure
yes,
you
I
understand
know.
What I'm talking about.
I do. I was just had this vision of just this, you know, running through this house, opening all these doors. I'm through. I'm like, no, it doesn't usually work that way.
No, I mean, yeah, it is definitely a journey. You know, it's just that, such a journey, and I am lately I've been thinking back to the beginning and how, you know, what a struggle and how desperate I was to be published, and then how desperate I was to get an agent, all the angst and all the conferences, and it was just so much hope and dreams and just fear of rejection, and it's just like so hard to wrap my mind around the fact that I'm here. You know, I mean, so it's just that's what I mean, you just keep walking forward, you just do the best you can, and then 20 years later, you know, you'll be somewhere. You'll be,
yeah.
hopefully you'll you know, so in my case, I just kept walking and the doors opened and I just kept writing, and so, you know, it's just a journey, and who knows where we'll be in the next few years, especially with all the crazy stuff going on. But we won't talk about that. So
no, we're not going to talk about that. This is a politics-free podcast. So we're narrow focused, which you know, take what you want from that, but we're going to keep it light and keep it fun. So I think the other thing that we wanted to talk about was, you know, the location, the setting for your novels. And I think that you have them set kind of all over, right? I mean, you don't have one particular spot.
Well, I do. I am, first let me just explain that I am a seventh-generation Texan and on both sides of my family. So I'm very Texan, but in 2010 we moved to Oregon. And I was able to, like, hike the redwoods, in the redwoods, and go to the coast and see so many beautiful things, and I just really started setting a lot of my novels in the Pacific Northwest, and so that's one place that I really love. And then I also have novels set in the Rocky Mountains, another place I love. So for me, setting is just, it's really what stirs my soul and it inspires me. So it's not like, oh, I've got the story I want to write. It's like, oh, I see this place and I really want to showcase this. I want to set a story here. So so a lot of my novels, again, are written in Oregon and in Washington, and also the panhandle of Alaska, which is kind of part of the Pacific Northwest, only, you know, there's some differences. And then, again, the Rocky Mountains, Wyoming and Montana. So those are several places I've been, and I love all the setting, and it inspires me.
So you say you are born and bred Texan. Do you set any novels in Texas? Because I did not hear Texas in that list.
I know. I know. I meant to recap with that. The only novel that is set in Texas is one that Love Inspired had asked me to write, a Texas Ranger in a continuity series where there's two other authors, and I wrote one of the books, and it was the Texas Ranger book. And so, that is my only book set in I love Texas, and I grew up there, and it feels like home, and most of my family lives there. But we would always take vacations when I was growing up to go to the mountains, to the Rocky Mountains, to Yellowstone National Park, and all these beautiful places. So that's kind of inside of me to go see the beautiful places. And so now I can write about them, and now I live in Washington. I live near the beautiful places. So let's say that. But Texas is awesome.
I was just was funny,
and,
though.
Know,
I just... Just cleaning out.
Actually, I do have to tell this one story that I actually was working on a proposal set in Texas. I'm trying to think, it was maybe 2012. And it was so hot. It was the summer. It was just so hot. Those 3 months of Texas blazing sun. And I thought, you know what? I do not want to be in this heat. So I wrote a proposal set in Alaska. and so I sold six books in that series, so just to get my head into the colder environment, I did that. So I don't know. It's just I thought
that
was
funny. No, I totally understand that. I'm like, that's why I like to read. You know, sometimes I like to read Christmas books in the summer. You know, I live in Virginia and it gets hot here. You know, not dry heat
cool
like
off.
Texas, but yeah, give me some cold. Give me some snow.
I got it. That's, yep.
Yeah. Yeah, to do that. So do you find there's something that you absolutely have to have when you write, quiet space, coffee, or can you write anywhere?
The things that I prefer to have, actually I have to have coffee before I do anything at all, not just writing, and actually someone else makes the coffee for me because I can't even make the coffee.
I've
had coffee. That's another story altogether. But I used to write in the middle of the chaos when, you know, my kids were little,
mm-hmm.
and the older I've gotten, the more quiet that I need. That said, as a professional writer, you just have to write no matter what, where whatever you're doing, wherever you are. But yes, my perfect writing would be quiet. And then if I'm in the middle of like a really hard scene or just trying to get the word count out, I really prefer to have peanut M&Ms. I rely on those. It just, whatever it is, the sugar, the chocolate, I'm not sure. It just kind of powers my brain. And so that's something else that I really need to have. But it's not good for me in any way.
No. So do you have to hide the stash from your kids? Are they out of
the
house
now? Oh, they know not to touch it. They know not to touch it. And they often will actually buy me big bags of it. I'm trying to wean myself, but in desperate times call for desperate measures. So
yes, yeah. No, I'm just laughing because I have almost four teenagers in the house. So let me just say that if I have any kind of chocolate at all, if I want it, I have to like hide it. So I used to
I
would just take part of the Costco size, you know, chocolate covered raisins and put them in a little jar, and I like hide it in my office so that nobody can see it.
Oh no, that's
but
a
me.
Good plan.
You know, because I would
steal it.
Right, and then I would think, oh, well, we still have some peanut M&Ms, and I would go up to get a little handful, and they're like, be gone. And I'm like, you know, I've got tired of that. So now, yes, I do tend to hide them from the children and.
Well, I am, as far as places to write or what I have to have, I do have a big, like a converted garage, you know, that's another room, a big office, and it also has all my exercise equipment in it. But I also have an office in the dining room corner. I have a desk. And then I end up writing in my recliner because it's so comfortable, you know, and so it's just comfortable. And that's a great place to write, but it's really bad for my health. So this year I'm looking at trying to get a treadmill desk. I don't know how that's going to work, you know, if that's going to be too distracting, but I really need to do something because, you know, writing is really bad for your health.
you're sitting.
And eating M&Ms.
I know. right, eating M&Ms. I know. So I don't have a stash now because I'm like, okay. But every once in a while, I just really want a couple, and then they're not there. So And one has to, yeah, but I don't know if I could do, or I don't know if I could write standing up. I'm not sure. I have a feeling that I would, the treadmill in me writing would might not work well. I don't know if I'm coordinated enough.
Yeah, I don't know either. I know people who do that. I know I have friends who write, you know, walk 8 to 10 miles a day riding. You have to walk really slow. And then I
yes.
have other friends who their neck hurts or, you know, it just doesn't work for them. So I'm still trying to figure it out. Is it going to work for me or not? So, you know, kind of to go back to the answer to your big question of is there certain things you need or whatever, I think, you know, those things change over time. You know, you have to adjust. And sometimes you need quiet or sometimes you can write in the middle or wherever. And as I said, that sometimes, you know, if I've got a deadline, it doesn't matter if I have company, whatever. I'm just going to be writing in the middle of it. It's not my
problem. Right, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, hopefully they would understand, you know, because this is their, you know, but they don't understand?
No, I was going to say, I don't think people really understand about writing, but that's another topic. You know, I mean, they don't, you know, if you're working from home, especially, you know, they don't really understand that you need, you're working. So, I mean, fully, I don't
yes.
think they fully understand how hard it is to write a novel, but that's another topic, so.
Right. But I will say, you know, this, I have, you know, as someone who has worked from home, I was a freelance writer and as a fiction writer too, you know, for many, many years, that finally I feel like everyone realizes you can work from home and actually work.
Oh, yeah.
If the pandemic has done anything, it's done well for us who were already home and already working and already apologizing for our children bursting in on our calls, right? And now they realize,
yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah, that yeah, you can work from home. And it's hard. So, you know, stop bothering me. I'm working.
Really, I am.
Yes,
you know, I'm
truly, I am. Yeah.
Somebody asked me. So, what did she ask? She said something about are you brainstorming, or are you writing, or when do you do all that? We were at a function, and I looked at her and said, "I'm writing right now."
Yeah.
In my head, you know what I'm saying? You're always coming up with stories, and every person is a character potentially, and so I'm always writing.
Yeah, we're
I mean,
always
I might
not be
at
gathering.
My laptop, but I'm always exactly intel and
information gathering. Yeah, I've I really have almost like taken pictures of strangers because I'm like, oh, I like that. But I've stopped myself because you know they were like too close. I couldn't do it like. Surreptitiously, and it would be pretty obvious I was snapping their picture. And
right.
So I'm like, I like that look, and I want to use it for one of my characters. Or
I usually names are what gets me. You know, when people, I'm like, oh, I love your name. Sometimes, depending on you know the situation, I'll say, I'm going to use that in a book, or you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes I say nothing and use it in a book anyway. But
right. I know you have to gauge whether it's like kind of stalky. Ish to say that, or if they're going to be flattered, or if they're going to say, you know, yeah.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah, I can, right. Well, we are almost at the end of our time here. This has been great, Elizabeth, so thank you so much for being on my show today.
And thank you for having me. It's been fun.
You have been listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense. I'm your host, Sarah Hammerker, and I'm so glad you've joined me today. My guest is Elizabeth Goddard. She's written more than 50 novels, and you can stay tuned for an excerpt from her latest, Present Danger.
Now an excerpt from Present Danger by Elizabeth Goddard. Chance Carter should have known this last delivery wouldn't go down without a hitch. A monstrous thunderhead had popped up in a clear morning sky and now loomed directly in his path as if forbidding, or at least challenging, his approach to his destination, a lone airstrip in nowhere, Montana. As an experienced pilot and courier for an air freight company, inclement weather didn't concern him as much as the troubled feeling in his chest, which he'd been trying to ignore since takeoff. Given the cold, hard stone of unease that had settled in his gut, he'd failed miserably. Earlier this morning, back at the FBO, fixed-based operator, the rhythm of his flight prep had seemed off. Excitement hadn't jumped through his every movement, and the usual bounce to his step hadn't accompanied him while he worked through his pre-flight checks. If that hadn't been enough, dread had replaced the anticipation that had always filled him as he readied to climb into the cockpit of his Piper Cherokee 235, which he affectionately called Old Blue. Now, as he neared the airstrip, he shook off the apprehension and grabbed onto the assurance earned from years of experience and hours spent piloting. A good, strong headwind buffeted the plane, which was preferred for landing. He took comfort in the familiar deafening roar of the Piper breaking through his headset and droning in his ears. He wanted to focus on nothing but landing, delivering, and escaping. But this trip carried him back, and the evergreens of the forest, the winding rivers, the meadows, the crops, and the majestic mountains captivated him, reminding him of all he'd left behind. Gripping the yoke, he sat taller and shoved beyond the melancholy. At 7 miles from his destination, he switched tanks. The noisy engine sputtered and then stalled. Nothing he didn't know how to handle. Chance would quickly remedy the situation. He trusted that forward movement and lift would propel Old Blue along like an eagle riding along the wind long enough to give him ample time to restart the engine. Only the engine refused its resurrection. The fuel gauge indicated a fourth tank of fuel remained. He switched to the other tank and confirmed it was empty. As if emphasizing his earlier presentiment, Old Blue's propeller slowed to a stop. Utter silence filled the cockpit. Moments passed before the slow cadence of his heartbeat ramped up and roared to life in his ears. The plane remained in the air, gliding on the current, but not for long. Creating a controlled descent was up to chance and the tools at his disposal. Sweat beaded at his temples as his instincts took over, and he maneuvered the rudder, flaps, and ailerons, steering the plane through the air currents to maintain lift as long as possible. Chance had to face the truth. Old Blue wasn't going to make it to the airstrip. And those evergreens he'd admired moments before rushed at him now as the ground rose toward him much faster than was safe. He was going down. Chance pressed the button on the yoke and squawked to a local frequency. "Mayday! Mayday! Mayday!" He detailed what he knew of the expected crash location, which wasn't a lot. He got no response. Nobody monitoring the frequency today in Nowhere, Montana. Just his luck. Between evergreen-topped mountains, Old Blue surfed along a ravine. Not a good place to land. He hoped for a clearing. Something.
"Come on, come on, come on!"
There. Between the trees, he caught sight of a forest road and aimed for it. It would be close. The trees were dense in places. Worst case, the wheels on his fixed-gear plane would catch the treetops and flip him forward. Dead or alive, he'd be stuck in the tops.
"Come on, baby, you can do this!"
Palms sweating, he squeezed the yoke. Continuing the mantra in his head, he willed Old Blue to stay in the air just a little longer. When he'd proclaimed today was his last delivery, he hadn't meant that to be a literal prophecy. He mentally shook his fist at God.
"You hear that? I didn't mean I wanted to die today. I just meant I'm doing what I do."
A thousand thoughts blew through his mind at once, not the least of which was that if he made it, if he survived, he'd have to file a crash report with the NTSB. He was only supposed to take his flight bag from the crash site, but he'd have to make an exception this time and remove the package he was supposed to deliver. The treetops reached up for Old Blue, their lofty trunks and branches growing taller, as if they would stretch to catch the plane's wheels. The piper shuddered. Chance held his breath, working the yoke until, finally, he maneuvered above the narrow road.
Lower, lower, lower.
The wheels touched down, and the plane bounced hard. Trees closed in on the narrowing road. Chance braced himself. The wingtips caught the trees. The sound of metal twisting and ripping vibrated through him as the tin can protecting him shook and rattled. The impact shattered the window and catapulted what was left of his plane, and Chance's body was flung like a rag doll despite the shoulder harness. Old Blue slammed against a tree on the passenger side, crumpling the only door. Chance's head hit the yoke handle. Thunder ignited in his temples as pain throbbed across his chest. But the plane had stopped, finally. Seconds ticked by. He drew in a few shuddering breaths, allowed his heart rate to slow. Chance assessed his injuries. He could move his legs and arms. Maybe he had a few broken ribs. He touched his head and felt the warm, sticky fluid. Blood covered his fingertips. He stared at the tree branch protruding through the shattered window, caught a whiff of pine from the needles, and tried to grasp the near miss. He could have been skewered. That was only one of many possible fatal injuries that could occur in a plane crash. How? How had he survived?
Thanks for listening to The Romantic Side of Suspense with Sarah Hammerker. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. You can sign up to receive notifications of upcoming podcasts and listen to previous editions at sarahhammerkerfiction.com.